The following episode of Cooking Issues has been brought to you by TechServe. This January, responsibly dispose of all your old electronics at one of 10 e-waste recycling events held across four boroughs of New York City, hosted by TechServe and the Lower East Side Ecology Center. Computers, printers, monitors, and lots of other electronics are being accepted for safe and proper recycling. Visit techserve.com/recycling for more information and drop-off location details.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network, coming to you live every Tuesday from 12 to 12:45. I'm Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues. You can call in all of your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Most of the time we take technical questions, but we'll take any question. Today, actually, Nastasha is not in the studio with me. She is live from, where the heck does your family live, Nastasha?
Near Pasadena in California, Southern California.
So not even in Pasadena, like near Pasadena?
Yeah, a very small town.
Anyway, so Nastasha's got up early in the morning, gathered all your questions, and is joining us across the country live. So how's it going over there, Nastasha? How's the weather?
Good, it's good. It's raining. Do you miss me yet? Wow.
Okay, so yes, of course, we always miss you when you go, Nastasha.
Okay, just
messing around. All right, so we have quite a bunch of questions to get to today. So let's start out, Steve. Okay, I'm going to try to pronounce his name, Mignogna. What do you think, Nastasha? You speak Italian, Steve Mignogna?
I think so. I think that's fine. Yeah, that's good.
I just got a thermal circulator. Congratulations. And for those of you that don't know, that's what allows us to do most of our low-temperature cooking because it keeps water temperatures very accurate. Great for the restaurant, great for dinner parties, great for cooking for your family. I use it all the time. I have two. Nastasha has none. If Philip Preston from Polyscience is listening, Nastasha Lopez would be great marketing tool for you to give a circulator to, just saying, maybe for Christmas.
Oh, don't do that.
Maybe for Christmas. I'm just saying.
Okay.
It's not too late, you know. I just got a thermal circulator, and I'll be using it to cook short ribs for my family for the holidays. Also a good idea. I do not have a lot of time this week to experiment with cooking temps and times, and I want some advice on which to use. My father, who's a big skeptic of any new cooking technique, I'm with you, Steve. I know what that's like. We'll be making short ribs the old-fashioned way, so we're going to have a short rib cook-off. Steve's seen different techniques between 55 degrees Celsius and 60 degrees Celsius, anywhere from 24 hours to 72 hours. Steve's leaning towards 58 degrees Celsius for 60 to 72 hours. You're not going to need to go that long. But anyway, I'll get into that in a second. Steve's ideal finished product would be a medium-rare short rib that is fork tender. He's not looking to replicate prime rib or fillet texture, which is good because they shouldn't be the same, but would rather have a more fork tender falling apart meat. Any thoughts? He says he knows that I recommend 60 degrees Celsius for 48 hours, which is 140 for all you Fahrenheit heads out there. But what's the final result with those numbers? Thank you. Okay, now, a lot to talk about here. And unfortunately, we're going to get into some technical minutia for all of you people who are going to space out on this. But look, here's the deal. Here's the good news and the bad news. I would not pit a low-temp short rib side-by-side against a regular short rib because I think they're different, and if someone's shooting for a good old-fashioned stick-to-your-rib short rib, the old-fashioned short rib's going to have kind of a beefier taste. It's also going to have more of a pull-apart texture. The low-temp short rib is, and Nastasha, you know this.
Yeah.
The low-temp short rib is going to, it's going to be soft and tender, but it is going to slice more like a steak, right? Right, Nastasha?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and it's not going to be rip apart like a regular short rib. But if you want something, I wouldn't go 58 degrees. 58 degrees it's pretty rare. I think people want a little bit of a meatier taste. They want it a little more cooked, but slightly pink on the inside. I mean, you could go as low as 57, which is about 135 Fahrenheit, and then you're in the medium. That's in the medium rare zone, but people aren't really expecting a short rib there. So what I would do is I would serve it entirely differently from the way your dad serves his short rib. I wouldn't try to replicate. I would just recognize that they're two entirely different products and serve it accordingly. I mean, I wouldn't like shred it up and serve it over a pile of like some kind of a starch product. What, I mean, Nastasha, you've eaten a lot of these things. I mean, and from someone who's doesn't come at it from the same perspective I do, what do you think about the traditional versus the low temp?
I actually haven't had a lot of traditional short ribs. I mean, whatever short ribs I've had have been at home, and, well, we all know how that is.
Yes, yes, Nastasha's family can overcook even short ribs, apparently. But, so, in other words, I wouldn't try to pit them against one another, although it's admirable. I have done it many times, and the traditional short rib is going to have a more traditional short rib texture. It's going to be beefier because it's going to be cooked at a higher temperature, but it's also going to be the meat fibers themselves are going to be overcooked. I would choose 60 degrees, because, Nastasha, you like the 60 better than the 57, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would do 60, and I would do it if you at 60 degrees, if you cook it for 24 hours, it will have the texture of skirt steak. At 48 hours, it will be a firmer but still tender short rib. At 72 hours, it will be, to my taste, too mushy. It will have lost too much of its texture. So I would go in between 48 and 72. I would say somewhere in the range of like 56 hours at 60 would be a good number. I would sear the meat both. I would sear it quickly, put a crust on it beforehand. The key to this technique is over-reducing your sauce before you put it in the bag. You must over-reduce your sauce. It has to be like almost gloppy, because what's going to happen is you're going to bag it with the sauce. The meat's going to give up its own juices into the bag and water down the sauce. It's going to taste like pot au feu, like a boiled beef, which is not what you're looking for. So you want to over-reduce the sauce. A couple hours before you serve it, I would then, after it's done cooking, I would let it chill down. Don't chill it right away, or the meat's not going to absorb a lot of the juices again. I would put it on the counter for about 20 minutes. Then you could put it in water for about, regular tap water for about 20 minutes, although that's an extra step. It does make it taste better, according to Bruno Gousseau and according to our independent taste tests afterwards. Then you can ice it down. I would then open the bag several hours before you're done, ready to cook. Scrape out the sauce that's rendered. Warm it on the stove. Correct the taste and temperature of it. It will likely need to be defatted. It will most certainly need acidity. Might need seasoning correction. Put it back into a Ziploc bag with the short rib. Don't let it, first then sear the short rib real quickly from cold, right, to put a little extra crust because it's going to look green and kind of weird. Throw it back into the bag and then re-therm it at like 55, 57 for up to 4 hours, but you could probably, like 2 or 3 hours, it'll reabsorb some of the new sauce that you've put in. It's going to be thick and juicy and delicious, and that is going to be a bang-up, delicious short rib, but it won't be the same thing as a traditional short rib. Any comments, Nastasha, on this?
No, that's good. And then he should let us know what his family thinks of his and his dad's.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I mean, like, it's like anything else. The low-temp short ribs, it's not. There are some things that are just better, right? That's the case. There are some techniques that are just better, and then there are techniques that are just different. A traditional short rib is different from a low-temperature short rib. A traditional short rib, you're basically almost boiling out the meat. The fibers themselves are horrendously overcooked, and then you render the collagen into gelatin. The gelatin plus the delicious braising sauce. By the way, the braising sauce is then reinforced with that gelatin, right? So you get an incredibly unctuous sauce, and that's what makes the deliciousness of a short rib. But those short ribs can't be sliced. Those short ribs don't have the same texture as a low-temperature short rib. Low-temperature short ribs aren't as unctuous because you don't render out the gelatin. The collagen breaks down, but when you slice into a low-temp short rib, you'll see that the collagen hasn't rendered out. You can still see where the collagen was. It's just become soft. So that stuff doesn't render out into the sauce and doesn't give that incredibly unctuous texture to the sauce. It also doesn't individually moisten each fiber of meat the way it does in a traditional braise. Furthermore, at a low temp, because you can see it slices, the fat doesn't render out, so you're going to have to slice off some of the fat. So it's all a question of what you're looking for. If you want something that you can slice into a beautiful presentation, is incredibly tender, but not the same as a traditional short rib, and you realize you're going to have to make up for some of the stuff you're going to lose, incredible beefy flavor, I would put some cooked rendered meat into your sauce beforehand. Don't just rely on the short ribs themselves to provide that beefiness, because they won't be there because you're not using a high temperature technique. So I would just try to keep in mind the benefits and disadvantages of each technique, realize that they are just different techniques. And does it have to be a competition? You know, ask your dad, Steve. Does it really have to be a competition? Anyway, happy...
You have, What? Do you have callers?
I do.
Because someone just emailed me and said that they can't get through. I don't know.
Is that true? Jack, what do you know about this? Jack, our trusty engineer. We're short staffed today in the radio station.
I see nothing.
Huh?
Did I give the right number? Anyway, call if you can hear me, caller. Try back again at 718. What is it, Jack? 718?
718-497-2128. Yeah, Nastasha, maybe tell them to try again.
Yeah, because
it's John Stewart. I hope it's the John Stewart.
Well, that would be amazing, but you know, I assume not. Well, John, if you are listening to me, you are the John Stewart. Anyway, see, Nastasha is so bad with customer service. I swear. You got to learn. Never learn. Okay,
guys, we've got John on the line.
Oh, we have John on the line. All right. Hi, John. How you doing?
Hi there.
Hey. Question for me?
Yes, sir. I just want to say, big fan. I've just discovered you guys a month or so ago and have now listened to all of your a backlog, and it's really, really fun. So you guys have inspired me to build my own immersion circulator.
Nice.
And get some spherification supplies. So I've been doing that for the past week or so here. So I'm experimenting with both of those, and I hope to use both of them in a New Year's Eve dinner that I host every year.
How many people?
It's going to be 12 to 14.
Okay, good. That's a good number to start with the circulator.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, last year I did so I guess there's three questions I have about that. So, last year I did a beef tenderloin, traditional cooking. It was good. Mm-hmm. Tenderloin's a crowd pleaser. And I guess, you know, sous vide is appropriate because I can, you know, control the temp, internal temp very well. But I'm wondering if there's something, I guess my question is, what do you think is the protein that is most improved by sous vide cooking? You know, I wonder if I should be more ambitious than just a tenderloin.
That's an excellent question, and strangely, one I haven't really thought of. So let's just break it apart between sous vide and the low temperature, right? Because most proteins can be done well, when I say well, I mean properly, low temp and to good effect, depending on what you're shooting for. Some proteins I don't like very much in sous vide, in a vacuum bag, because I find that affects their texture. Chicken, most notably, and certain fish. But are you going to be ziplocking, or are you going to be doing vacuum?
Just Ziploc. I don't have a vacuum device.
By the way, I use Ziploc at home. That's what I use.
Right.
And I'm assuming that your circulator is going to be able to do, like, about a degree or so. I mean, are you going to PID control it?
It's PID controlled. It should be accurate within, you know, tenths of a degree, really.
Couple tenths. All right, good. Okay, so and as long as you have good circulation, it'll be accurate across the bath. Okay, fine. So you can do pretty much anything you want. Here's the good news about tenderloin is that it's fairly easy. You want to go super low temp on a tenderloin. We're talking like 55, 54, like as low, right? And I wouldn't cook the tenderloin whole. I would cook it in, I would pre-slice it out, sear, and put it in the Ziplocs and get it ready to go. Here's the main problem with the tenderloin, and one of the great things I love about cooking steaks in low temp, because that's, by the way, like, in fact, I might do this soon. It's one of my favorite, like, dinner party things, because it's going to be really easy for you to do. Like, you're going to be a rock star, and it's also going to be easy, right? I prefer a big, thick rib steak, like thick, you know, and the bad news about the tenderloin is if it cooks much more than about 40, like 45 is ideal. If it cooks much longer, like an hour and a half or so, because there's no connective tissue in the tenderloin, it's going to start to feel kind of fibery. So for someone who's not used to it or is used to overcook tenderloin in general, they'll think it's fine, but you probably won't think it's as good as it could be. I mean, you can do a bang-up job on the tenderloin, but it's just, you know, you have to be careful not to cook it too long. I mean, one of the great tenderloin applications low temp is the beef Wellington, where you can cook the whole tenderloin, like, you know, for a short period of time all the way through, then wrap it in a puff, and then hit it really hard in the oven so that you don't overcook the meat because it's already cooked. You don't need to worry about it. Technique we call low temperature for insurance purposes. But if you go rib steak, and I like to serve the rib steak, you know, what I'll do is I'll buy like a standing rib roast for a party, then I'll slice it into steaks, right? I'll usually take the bone off, maybe render that to make some meaty stuff, then take the steaks, cut them real thick, then I sear them, and I actually sear them a lot longer than I normally talk about to put a heavy crust on them, because I make them so thick that you're not really losing that much meat by doing it. It really gives a nice kind of crust and meaty flavor on the outside. You know, salt and pepper the heck out of them. Then I throw them in a bag with butter. I throw garlic in. Some people don't like that, but then I use the butter afterwards to make garlic bread so that I have a no-waste situation, right? Then the advantage of a rib steak as opposed to a tenderloin is a rib steak can cook for, you know, like a minimum for a real thick steak of, you know, an hour and a half or so, but up to like five, six hours, your window is a lot longer, and you're not going to have, you know, so if people don't sit down or if something happens, you're not working right at the edge, and you're not worried about the texture going bad on you, right? And then about an hour before service or so, I would turn the bath down to 52, I mean, don't say I said so, but 50 Celsius, so that the whole temperature of the steak drops down a little bit, so that when you put a real monster sear on the outside, when you take it out, you could put a really good crust on it without raising the internal temperatures too much on the center of the meat. Then, you know, you just, you know, and you can do that steak by steak. So for a party, you could, if you have like, you know, four steaks that you're serving out, you know, really thick ones, you could do two, slice them down, send them out, and, you know, then do the next, you know, then, you know, take a 5-minute break, do the next two while you sear off the next two and bring them out. And it's, you know, that's the way I run my dinner parties. Nastasha, you've been to my house for steak, right?
Yeah, no, not for steak, but I've had the steak that you're talking about before, yeah.
The one where I drop it? Well, yeah, you made it. We did it at the school, and you made it. I mean, that's it's a crazy awesome way to have a dinner party, right, Nastasha?
Yeah, it's delicious.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would do that over tenderloin. I mean, it used to be, and this is like, you know, and it's not me being misogynist. I'm just like, this is what I used to hear, right? That the ladies, they like the tenderloin. And, but I think nowadays, you know, I think, you know, even people who used to go on those old, you know, sex-based stereotypes, which I never buy into, but, you know, that go on it, I think everyone realizes now that a dude thinks it's like mucho sexy for a woman to tear into a rib steak. Am I right about this?
Yes.
Yeah. It's like it's become kind of chic for women to order like a neat scotch at a bar, because it's a sign that, you know, that you're a butt kicker. Am I wrong about this?
No, anyway. I agree.
Yeah. Anyway, is this helpful at all, by the way, for your dinner party?
Yeah, no, that's a great suggestion. So what temperature, so you say 50°C to like finish it off, but what about the, you know, few hours cooking beforehand, what temp would you use there?
Okay, so I would do my personal, some people I know like to do as low as, some people cook really low, which I don't, but like 55 to 56 in that range.
Okay.
Like, so a good like middle ground is like 55.2 or 55.5. If you have a chance to practice on one rib steak before you do it, so you can get a feel for what it's like, that at 55.5, it won't be squashy at all in the center, especially if you cook it long enough, it will be good. 56 sometimes is a little too tight for people. You know, especially for rare heads, it's a little too tight. But like 55.5, the squeamish people, if they look at it, they might say that it's underdone. But once they eat it, they're going to like it. And and the rare heads aren't going to be – it's a good compromise, right? Especially if you drop it so that the temperature goes lower and you put a good hard sear on it. No one's – if their eyes are closed, no one's going to quibble with the texture. It's just a question of how it looks. And then, of course, you know, even though – I make fun of a lot of Nastasha is partial to any kind of Italian. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's Italian, it's good. So, you know, so I bust on her all the time about it anyway. So, but that said, when I do steak at home, I go Italian style and I drizzle some delicious olive oil over it. And you know, some crunchy Maldon salt, and I've never had a complaint. So
sounds delicious. Okay, great. So that's very helpful. I appreciate it. So the other question is about then spherification. So one thing I want to try to do is sort of a deconstructed Bellini.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to do like a reverse spherification of peach,
right,
and then drop that in Prosecco.
Right.
So I'm obviously very new to this. What I've found online basically is that the idea is I'll put some calcium lactate in the peach puree.
Right. Get calcium lactate gluconate. Don't get just straight lactate. Get calcium lactate gluconate, because it has no taste. Calcium lactate still has some taste.
Okay, so that was my third question then, is what is the difference between lactate and lactate gluconate? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so then I'll basically then freeze it. So the ratio was about 2.5%, I think, for the calcium lactate gluconate.
Yeah, 2 to 2.5, somewhere in there. That's good. Okay. You have to and warm the peach puree to get it to dissolve properly.
Okay.
Not hot. You don't have to make it hot, but you should warm it. I mean, sometimes you don't need to, but you just want to be sure, you know.
Okay. And then just drop that into a sodium alginate bath at 0.5% is, I think, what I found.
0.5? It depends on your alginate. If you have a really strong alginate, then 0.5 would probably work. If you have a weak alginate, then you might have to go as high as 0.8, 0.9. It all depends on your alginate. I'd try a couple different... ratios. Also, how long you let it sit in the alginate bath, the skin is going to keep growing on it. What I would do, if you can make them beforehand, you put them in the alginate bath, you let them sit for however long, depends on your alginate and whatnot. Fish it out carefully. Don't let them touch each other. They'll glue to each other, okay?
Uh-huh.
Then you're going to want to rinse it off in water. And they get the excess alginate off of it. And then you can put it into a calcium bath briefly just to make sure everything's set up. Now, you can let them thaw in the calcium bath. You can let them thaw in peach puree. You can let them thaw inside of your champagne flute if you want. But what you can't do is let it thaw in – you can't leave it in the alginate too long. And you can't let it thaw and stay in a regular straight water bath or calcium bath because the sugar and the flavor and the color are going to leach out over time. So
through the shell.
Yeah. Yeah, it's water. Okay. It's water, you know, it's semi-porous, so you're going to leak the stuff out. It becomes like a membrane, and you have osmosis across that membrane, and you tend to lose color and flavor and sugar and acidity. It doesn't take that long. So, I mean, don't worry about it when you're making it, but I'm saying don't store it for hours and hours in a water bath. You can store it directly in your calcium-based peach puree, which is always good. Or you can let them finish thawing in your champagne flute. The good news about letting it thaw in the champagne flute is it's easy to get in without breaking. The bad news is that if you have a broken one, you're not going to know until you pour the champagne in. So, you know, it turns out you can never win. You know, do you ever notice this?
Yeah. And then how long, I mean, when you prep something like that and then put it in the peach puree, like leave it sit in the peach puree, how long is it good in that situation? I mean, how long ahead can I make these?
Long time. I mean, I've never done it with the big ones to kept them a long time because I just do them for like an event or for the classes. But, you know, I've had reverse spherification maple syrup balls that we've kept for Nastasha. How long have we kept those things? Like a week?
Yeah.
Like a week? As long as it's isotonic, right? If you're storing it in the same stuff it's made out of and there's some calcium there, then you'll be okay until the stuff goes bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
We got to take a break.
Great.
Oh, yeah. We're going to our first commercial break. Thanks for your call in, and good luck. Let us know how it works out.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank
Great
you.
Show.
All right.
Oh, how you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Play so much bone, brother. How you feel, man? Call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here. How you feel, fella? Hey, Jeff! Sure getting down. Look at him! Ha. We're gonna have a bunk good time. 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 Let's take them up, Fred. You want to do it again, huh?
Welcome back to Cooking Issues. Call in all your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Coming to you live for another segment or two. And by the way, Heritage Radio Network is on hiatus. Hey, Nastasha, I get to use the word hiatus. You like that?
Yes.
We're on hiatus next week, and we'll be coming back to you, I guess that means, in the new year. So this is our holiday edition. Yeah?
Yeah, I said that earlier.
Well, it goes to show what I know. I was busy. I'm building a new computer at home, and my head's been stuck in the sand. Sand is the polite word. Anyway, while we're talking about low-temperature cooking, And again, if this is the first time you've ever heard me rant on about it, low temperature cooking doesn't mean that you're cooking something to a low temperature. It doesn't mean raw. And, you know, raw cooking we're going to get into next year. Nastasha, we have to set a date. We have to set a date for our raw cooking extravaganza, our week
of raw cooking. This is the last week of January.
Is it already set, the last week of January?
We don't have anything to do, and I think it's a good time.
We have no other events?
No.
All right, people, last week of January is Cooking Issues Raw Food Week extravaganza. Not just raw, by the way, because I can't stand to be called a sissy in public. Well, that's not true. I let it slide all the time, but not when it comes to food. So, you know, you can call me a physical coward. You know, you can call me like a relationship sissy. That's fine. But food sissy, no love. Anyway, so we're going to do the raw food challenge the last week of January. I've already purchased with my own money an Excalibur dehydrator because all the schools were stolen. We're sourcing a champion juicer. I'm going to go on this for a second before I answer the next question. Unless a caller calls in, I'll take them right away because that's service for you. So here's some things, Nastasha. We have to think. Nastasha and I have read now, what, like 8, 9 raw food cookbooks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, be nice.
Well, I'm not going to go post-apocalyptic.
Okay.
In fact, you can't cook raw food in a post-apocalyptic situation because you won't have your VitaPrep, you won't have your dehydrator, your champion juicer, all that. The question is, can we, at the Cooking Issues team, can we bring some stuff to the table that other raw food people haven't brought to the table yet? Yes, right? First of all, I'm going to rotovap some stuff. I'm going to make some hyper-low temperature reductions. Now, I might get called a sissy here because it's not going to be useful for all the raw food people out there because they can't do that. But we can do distillations at low temperature. We can do fruit reductions, things like that, well below the 118 mark. So we're definitely going to do some of that, right? I'm also interested in using trying to find some good recipes for the Santha, the wet grinder that they use for dolls, see whether we can't get some new interesting recipes using the wet grinder from a raw food perspective. And I'm also, I'm going to use a bunch of enzymes. I mean, right, Nastasha, there's nothing wrong with using a commercially available enzyme prep. I mean, enzyme is the whole dealy, right? I mean, why can't we use enzymes? Now, if I can get a hold of straight transglutaminase. It doesn't have any maltodextrin in it. It's been heated. And it doesn't have any milk casein. I don't see why we can't use some transglutaminase to glue some raw proteins together. I mean, it might be fun, right? So these are the kinds of things I'm thinking about for our raw food extravaganza, which we've now publicly announced so that we're not welching, is going to be the last week in January, which means we have to start cooking now. You know all those raw food recipes.
Exactly.
There's all the raw food recipes are, you know, stick some almonds in water and, you know, wait 8 years and you'll be able to eat. You know, like the cooking instructions are so bananas and all these things because it just takes so dang long to do. Anyway, we will do it and we're going to do a good job and it won't be any. Yes, we're going to do a good job. Okay. Kurt writes in, my Cuisinart slow cooker seems to hold a fairly constant 165 degrees Fahrenheit, 74 degrees Celsius, when on the warm setting. Is this temperature useful for any low-temperature cooking applications, or is it simply too hot? Kurt, I am sorry. It is simply too hot. It's good for traditional cooks and braises. You know, something you could do in it that is going to be good is, for instance, if you want to do a duck confit, but you don't want to have to worry about it, right? You can put into a bag, and even listen, the S.C. Johnson Wax, a family corporation. You guys familiar with these people? They make the Ziploc bags. They will write in and call me a bad human being if I say you can do this because their bags can't take boiling temperatures. The polyethylene in them can't take boiling temperatures. But if in fact your thing doesn't go above 74, it should be able to handle this okay. If you take a duck leg and even just a couple extra tablespoons of fat, and you salt cure it with like thyme and herbs and whatnot for, you know, the recommended procedure, like overnight, you know, a day or so, and then put it in that Ziploc bag. You could put it in your slow cooker and leave it for like, you know, several hours, and you can make a very good duck confit that way without having to have a lot of fat. So it's really good to do stuff like that. in a similar vein, any traditional braise like that, or any confit, I should say, not a traditional braise, but any confit is great in that, something like that, because I actually prefer the higher temperatures, the more traditional temperatures, but I like to be able to do it without having to have boatloads of fat around, just because it gets expensive and messy, and then you need to cool it in the fat, which is a pain in the butt. And so I think it's a really good technique, but just don't tell the SC Johnson Wax people on me. What do you think, Nastasia? Yeah?
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah. That's good to know for me, because that's all I have here at home.
Yeah? All right. Well, I will say that when I use a circulator, 9 out of 10 times, my circulators, unless I'm doing creme anglaise or a test for, like, vegetables at a higher temp, or, like, we're working on nixtamalization, unless I'm doing something kind of special like that, my circulator is set at below 63, really, most of the time. Below 62. In fact, at 60 or below, 90% of the time. You know, I'll do most of my steak work in the 55 range in there, duck at like 57, and then chicken at 63 to 65. I should have said 65. So that range is where I am, never really above that, unless I'm doing creme anglaise or something special. But it's really great for confit, and there ain't much more delicious than confit. Let me see. Michael writes in and says, "Hello, Nastasia. Here's a question for Dave." Hi, Michael. "How can I make my own fizzing tablet like Alka-Seltzer or Airborne? Obviously, I'd like to be able to give it an intense flavor and have whatever mineral salt is used in the tablet base not be too overpowering. I think the main thing I'm not sure about is how to bind the powder into a tablet. Thanks, Michael." Okay. There are two ways to... Well, I'm sure there's a billion ways to make tablets, right? Like, the easiest way isn't going to work for you, which is you put the ingredients into a gum paste and then, like, cut them or you know, push them into tablet shapes and let them dry out. This is going to give you a texture similar to an Altoid, right? But not kind of a hard, shiny tablet. The next easiest way, and that won't work for this because I don't think that if there's any liquid when you combine that, the way you make a fizzy tablet is you combine an acid, typically some mixture of citric, malic, or tartaric acids, right? And I guess you could do lactic or something like that, but typically it's either citric, malic, tartaric, or a blend with a base. Typically something like baking soda, like sodium bicarbonate, although some people use, potassium bicarbonate or, you know, other mixtures of bicarbs, right? And when they combine in liquid in your mouth, they fizz, right? And this is the same thing that happens when you make a volcano when you're a kid, when you add vinegar to baking soda and you get this volcano that spews up, right? Now, how are you going to get these into a tablet? That's the question. Okay. The easiest way, not very satisfying, but the easiest way is to buy empty gel caps. And you can get those. I know Whole Foods sells them. They're basically – the Whole Foods doesn't sell the gelatin ones. They sell like a carrageenan-based one. But GNC or any of these places where there's kind of people making their own pills all the time, or you can get them on the internets, you get gel caps. And you can fill the gel caps, push them together to form capsules, and they'll melt fairly quickly on the tongue and if you let it sit there and go acid. But I get a feeling this is not what you want to do. What you want is something called a tablet press. Okay, and the way a tablet press works is you take a bunch of ingredients and binders. They use like dextrose powder, probably some sometimes some maltodextrin, whatever your flavoring is, and maybe some oil-based agents. I'm not sure, but they mix it all up and then they put it into a two-sided press, and then a press comes down and bang, smashes it into a capsule form. And if you're really rich, you can write your name in it and stuff like that. Now, these presses, they're not cheap, right? They have manual versions of them. I looked on eBay this morning, and there's someone – it's called a tablet press. There's someone selling a hand one for $50 that I think you put the ingredients into a little cylinder, and you screw it down almost like you're screwing down like a jack, and it smushes a tablet and then opens up, and you have it – bang, you have a tablet. I don't know how fast those are. When I used to do leather work back in the day when I was a leather worker with my wife making bags a long time ago –
I had something called a kick press that I used to use to do put snaps into things and grommets, and they have all different dies. That would probably be the next level up. I don't know if they provide enough force to make a tablet, but I didn't really research it long enough. But all the big machines, they use like a hydraulic power, and you press it and they squish it down. But now you're talking like a several thousand dollar problem instead of a $50 problem. Or for the kick press, if you buy it used, if it is the same kind of press that you use to do snaps and grommet work, you're talking like a $100, $150 problem, something like that. But that's how you make the tablets. The trick is making sure that you don't have an excess of base. It's usually okay to have an excess of acid because we like acidity in our tablets. It's not okay to have an excess of base. In fact, you need an excess of acid. If you don't, it's not going to have any acidity to it. You will have a salty aftertaste that comes along with the acid and the base mixing and producing a salt. So I would choose a salt that you like the flavor of, usually sodium salts. I think tastes better than the potassium salts. Nastasha hates the potassium salts.
Yes, I do.
Yes, she does, and she tells me all the time. Anyway, is that helpful, you think, Nastasha? No?
I think that's helpful. Let's take one last break.
All right, we're going to go to a commercial break. Call in all your questions to 718-497-2128. 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues.
How you feel, brother?
Feeling good.
You feel good?
Feeling good.
Made so much bone, brother. Call your name. I don't want no people to know you're in here.
Yeah.
How you feel, fella?
Right.
Hey, yeah. Sure getting down. Look at him. Ha. We're gonna have a bunk good time. We're gonna have a bunk good time. We're gonna have a bunk good time. We're gonna have a bunk good time.
Let's take them up, Fred.
You want to do it again, huh?
Yeah, let's go on.
We gotta take you high. Yeah. Brother.
Yeah.
Now I want everybody. Let Red blow about two choruses.
Welcome back to the holiday edition of Cooking Issues. Call in all of your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. We'll probably maybe extend it a little bit, Nastasha, go another 15 minutes. So if you can make it to Nastasha's door outside of Pasadena in the next 15 minutes, you can ask her a question in person. just kidding. Please don't do that.
Please don't do that.
Please don't. Her mom will probably, put some buckshot into you. Yeah. Okay. William called in. He couldn't get the live feed, so he sent an email in. And he said Dave mentioned lab sales where you can find old RotoVaps. It's a rotary evaporator, a circulator, which is, we've been talking about a lot today, that you can find pretty cheap and just need to clean up and maybe fix a few fuses on. I tried my Google Kung Fu for auctions or sales in the NYC area and haven't found anything. Do you have any resources I could check out to find these kinds of sales? I've never gone to a live lab sale. I get all basically of my lab equipment off of eBay, and just base it on finding either. Occasionally, someone will flood the market. That happened with RotoVaps a couple times, and actually recently the market on eBay was flooded with RotoVaps, so the price went down. But it's starting to go back up again. There's centrifuges and things like that. LabX is another website. LabX is another place that a lot of lab people go to get lab equipment. The live auctions that I go to are mainly restaurant auctions. There's not a lot of labs in New York that go out of business. There's a lot of restaurants that go out of business or change owners or for whatever reason have auctions. So all the live auctions that I've gone to in the New York area have been either restaurant auctions, or I used to go to New Jersey and Brooklyn a lot for machine shop auctions back in the day when I was in the art biz. And I used to do that a lot. And those I always found in the in the New York Times, in the used to be at the back of the Help Wanted ads. I don't know if it is anymore. But if you've never been to a restaurant auction, it's something to behold. It's a crazy situation, especially if you need 8,000 pans that have been beat to hell for like a nickel a piece, my deep fryer. I bought one of those things for $50, and they're crazy. I mean, you can get some crazy deals at those. But I've never been to a lab one. Now, eBay, the way to go. And just look for, if you can fix things, look for things that are not working, but that you feel that you can troubleshoot based on the description. You have to take chances. I've had things that I couldn't fix. It's rare, but I've had things that I couldn't fix for a reasonable amount of money. But, you know, that's basically what I do. I take my chances on eBay. It's a lot better if you can go to a live auction and kick the tires. For that, you can look in the back of the New York Times, and they will have, like, major lab auctions that show up that you can go to live, but they're not usually in the New York City area. They're around. but, you know, Eli Lilly did that a while ago, and there are people who deal with that. Hope that's helpful. Didn't sound so helpful, but I didn't feel very helpful. Was? All right. Didn't feel helpful. Okay. Teddy DeVico writes in. Hey, Teddy, how you doing? He's asked some questions before. Recently watched Wiley. That would be Wiley Dufresne, my brother-in-law, friend of the blog. Wiley's Meat Glue Mania presentation for Harvard's food science class. That's the class that Farhan Adria is heading up at Harvard. We have a lot of good friends speak there. I think McGee spoken there, Wiley, Dave Chang, but didn't ask us, right, Nastasha? Didn't ask us, not us, no.
No.
We know why? We're chumps.
Why?
Chumps. We're chumps.
Low quality.
Yeah. Low quality. We're low quality people. This sparked an idea. I think it would be possible to make hot ice cream using an ice cream base, transglutaminase YG, which is the yogurt transglutaminase. Transglutaminase binds proteins together, including milk proteins, so it makes yogurt, so it weeps less and holds together better. Methylcellulose and gelatin gum. Do you think this would work? I should be receiving my sample of Activa soon. Thank you. No, I don't think it will work. Here's the deal. Hot ice cream is one of those things that people have been trying to make for years and years and years and years. The first hot ice cream attempts were made by a physicist named Nicolas Curti, who is kind of one of the people in the 60s who really started, 70s, started really popularizing science in the kitchen. He was, he knew McGee. He was one of the original people in the molecular gastronomy conferences in Ariche. And he wanted to make hot ice cream for a long time. It didn't work out for him. Wiley Dufresne took it on for a long time as something he wanted to do. He was working on it a lot back in the year, 2000, 2001 in there, and not able to do it. I've had other bloggers and peoples and who shall remain nameless, their recipes for hot ice cream, and none of them taste like ice cream. The problem with ice cream. So the theory is, I can make something that has the texture of a melted ice cream, right? So that's the gel end. So you're making a fluid gel that holds its shape even when it's either hot or cold, doesn't matter, and has the texture of like a nice ice cream base. Can you do that? Yes. Can you take a methocel and make it firm up when you heat it? Yes, right? And that's what all the hot ice cream recipes are based on, some form of methocel that melts when it puts in your mouth and gets cooler, right? But none of them have the texture as ice cream. None of them are as hard as ice cream. They don't have the bite of ice cream. Ice cream is like a chilling effect in the mouth. It's just nothing I've had approximates what you want in your head is something that provides that the feeling of ice cream, but is somehow reversed from hot to cold, from cold to hot. And I've tasted a bunch of people's different recipes for it, and I've never had something that provided an experience that I thought was satisfying. I think it's one of those. It's like the philosopher's stone of new cooking techniques. Everyone's had their hand, tried to make it, and just like you can't turn lead to gold, I don't think you can make a hot ice cream. I can't think of a good bet to make on it. Like we did on the raw foods, but I would want to have it. Like I hope someone could make it because I think it would be really fun. But I've not had one so far that I thought was totally successful. Wiley made one. He said he can get the texture of soft serve okay, but not like the hard ice cream. That's even like the super holy grail is the hard ice cream. So I hope you have success. If you call the different recipes on the internet, there are several for hot ice cream. And I want you to have success. It's just I'm dubious. I'm dubious as to whether or not you will be able to achieve it. What do you, Nastasha? Am I being too? I'm not being hard. I'm just.
No.
This is, you know.
I mean, I think the. I'm not really sure what you're talking about, but I think your brulee ice cream is really good.
Yeah, but that's different. That's cold ice cream.
Yeah, I know, but I can't even like register hot ice cream in my head.
Right. I mean, well, imagine something that's exactly the opposite of ice cream. It's like ice cream in Bizarro World, you know? It's yeah. it's hard when it's hot, and then when you put it in your mouth, it cools off because it's, you know, you're cooler than it, and then it yeah. melts in your mouth instead of you heating it to melt it. It's like everything Bizarro. But yeah. And I know many people who've tried to do it. It's just I've never had one that I thought, "Man, that's ice cream only hot." You know, mm-hmm. the Brulee ice cream is good, but it's still you know, it's ice cream. It's cold in the center. Yeah. But Teddy, I want you to work on this problem. This is you're traveling a good line of thought, traveled by many, you know, very very smart and very good people before you. So maybe you can succeed where they have not. I hope so, because that would be fun. So tell us what kind of results you have with it. Michael Natkin writes in. And hello, he says, hello. He has tapioca maltodextrin, which I've used for the usual tricks of turning various fats into soils and powders. By the way, Michael, remember, don't call it just tapioca maltodextrin. The one that turns oils into powders is Enzorbit tapioca maltodextrin from the National Starch Corporation, right? Not all tapioca maltodextrins will turn fats into powders. In fact, almost none will, except for Enzorbit, because of its particular structure. It's a bulking agent, okay? That's why it's so light. In the Fat Duck Cookbook, Michael continues, Heston Blumenthal talks about maltodextrin DE19, which he says is a low-sweetness sugar that he uses to make savory ice creams. Are these the same or closely related products? Can I use my tapioca maltodextrin in this kind of application? And would either of them be useful in making a low-sweetness vegetarian savory marshmallow? Okay. Here are my two cents on that. They're not equivalent, okay? Maltodextrins are – so basically you take a starch. It could be tapioca, could be rice, could be – you know, anything, corn, could be whatever. And you have a starch, which is basically a length of repeating glucose chains, units, right? And you break it down into smaller things. So the smallest thing you can break them up into is sugars, right? You know, glucose and glucose syrups. And then slightly longer, eight glucose units long, you have seven glucose units long. These are called maltodextrins, right? And they can either be not sweet if the chain is fairly long. The longer a glucose chain is, the less sweet it is, right? So the longer chain maltodextrins aren't sweet at all, really. And so the Enzorbit brand tapioca maltodextrin is not sweet at all. But it doesn't really act like sugar the same way. The shorter chain ones can start tasting sweet to you, right? So DE19 means that it has that powder has the I think this has been a long time, but it's basically 19% as sweet as sugar per unit weight, right? And it's composed therefore of fairly short glucose unit, you know, chains of glucoses, right? Anything much higher than that, and you're dealing with like a glucose syrup, which are also not that sweet compared to sugar. You're talking on the order of like a fifth of the sweetness of sugar. And so you can use them for things like savory ice creams, which we do all the time at the school. We make an ice cream one of Nils's old recipes that is goat cheese ice cream, where we use glucose syrup, which has a slightly higher DE, i.e., slightly more sweet than the maltodextrin you're talking about, which is a DE of 19. We're like DE 20, DE in the low 20s range, and we make like. Basically, not savory, but not sweet ice creams with that. I don't know how useful they'd be for making a marshmallow because I don't know exactly how close the properties are to sugar. And sugar is not—it's not only like a texture; it's a structural component in your marshmallows. So I would tend to think that you'd be better off using something like an isomalt. Isomalt is half the sweetness of sugar, but cooks a lot like sugar. So for a marshmallow, I would go ahead and use something like isomalt. The problem if you use too much isomalt, and I love isomalt, but if you use too much isomalt, like if someone eats like 8 bags of isomalt marshmallows, they're going to get the poops. Yeah, so because you don't digest it the same way necessarily, so like some of it goes as fiber, and so you can get the poops from it. Anyway, so I'm told. I have never gotten the poops from too much isomalt, but I got a cast on her stomach. I should feed some to Nastasha because, you know, if anyone says they're going to have a problem with it, Nastasha will say she's going to have a problem with it. Am I right about this?
That's right.
Yeah? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Yeah, well, I had something else on that, something else on sugar. Oh, I once tried to make savory marshmallows with this product called Lites, which is a modified sugar product that has zero sweetness. But I don't even know if that stuff's on the market anymore. I didn't have much success with it. It always absorbed too much water out of the air, and they got too weepy. See, Michael's taking on a double-edged problem. First, he's got to get the good vegetarian marshmallow, which means you have to get the right carrageenan product to mix with it. Then, to take it the next step and want to make it savory, then you got to get the right kind of savory product. I would definitely start with isomalt. Definitely. Right, Nastasia? Yes. No. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So we
come on, Dave. What, you have the goose question? Are you gonna answer that?
Oh, the goose question. What was the goose question? Did I get that one?
Yeah, it's number five.
Give me the goose question.
Other than deep frying, this is from Adam.
Right.
Other than deep frying, what would you suggest for cooking Christmas goose for the first time? My mother never let us have it because she thinks it's too greasy. I want to show her that she's wrong.
Ha, goose. It's an interesting problem. I have cooked goose several times. It's sometimes hard to get like a meaty goose, and so it seems greasy or it seems tough because it's not, you know. I would – goose. I mean – the question is, does he have a circulator?
We don't know.
We don't know if he has a circulator. I mean, goose would be great in a circulator and then crisped up in a really, really hot oven. Dang, cook a goose. I would do goose to try and render out. If you're worried about greasiness, I would try to render out as much of the fat. Now, this is totally just off the top of my head, by the way. So, you know, take this with, a box of salt instead of just a single grain. But I would maybe do something like you do with a Peking duck almost, where you kind of separate the skin away, then you put the hot liquid over it, and then you allow it to air dry a little bit, and then I think you like with a fan, and then you could probably render out a good bit of the fat and make it not so greasy. So I would treat it, if you don't have a circulator, I would treat it as if it were a Peking duck. If I had a circulator, I would break off the legs. And then, by the way, Booker, my oldest son, has started every 5 minutes. He comes to me. He's like, "I thought chickens made meat. I didn't know you had to break the head off of a chicken to get chicken meat." And then I'm like, "Yes, you have to break the head off a chicken to get chicken meat." And he goes, "Do you break the heads off of chickens?" I'm like, "No. I mean, I would if I had to. I mean, I think it's kind of an obligation." But he's like, "Well, why not?" I was like, "Well, we buy it from a butcher." But it's like so brutal. He's like, "Break the head off a chicken." That's what he says. Break the head off of a turkey. That's like, that's his imagery. Is that somehow you walk up to it, it's alive, and you break its head off, which I guess not that far from the truth. But it's just hearing an 8-year-old use terms like break the head off of. Anyway, if I had a circulator, I'd break the legs off the goose and then cook them separately, because they're going to want to be at a higher temperature and cook for a long time to break it down, whereas the breast meat's going to get dry and overcooked if you let it go that long. So I would break it down, do the breast low temp. I would do it at probably 57 or 58 for about 45 minutes, cool it down, sear off the skin to crisp it up, and then do the legs almost probably confit style. But that's me. But deep frying, obviously a great alternative, because deep frying is God's cooking technique. what do you think? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So this, I guess, will be the last cooking issues of this year, of 2010. We're going to come back in 2011. A little bit of an announcement. Nils is the intrepid leader of the French culinary program. He's not leaving the FCI, but he is changing his roles. He's stepping down from that role. He's going more on a consultant basis. And so he came to us, and I think he's going to be probably off the cooking issues masthead, he said, right? Because he's moving on, doing other things. Is that what he said
right.
to us, Nastasia?
Yes.
So that's big news. But, he got put in Eater and various other blogs, kind of incorrect information about the whole situation. Nils is just wanted to do some other stuff and is very time consuming, busy job running the culinary program at the French Culinary, especially because we're expanding and doing a lot of other things. And I think he just wanted to cook more and run schools less, right?
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yes.
As should anyone who likes to cook. They should be wanting to cook more. And so that is all of our New Year's resolutions from here at Cooking Issues. Cook more, and we'll catch you in the new year. Thanks for listening.
Happy holidays.